All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. Nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws.
The date was May 17, 1954, almost 86 years to the day since the 14th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States was ratified. The amendment which guarantees all American citizens equal protection of the laws, but which remained perhaps the most unfamiliar law of the land. But now, the Supreme Court of the United States would announce its decision as to whether this amendment applied to education. The time was 12:52 p.m. At the long mahogany bench sat the nine justices of the Supreme Court. From the red velour draperies behind the bench to the great doors at the back of the room, every seat was filled. Earl Warren, Chief Justice of the United States, picked up a printed document and began to read in a firm, clear voice.
These cases come to us from the states of Kansas, South Carolina, Virginia, and Delaware. They are premised on different facts and different local conditions, but a common legal question justifies their consideration together in this consolidated opinion. In each of the cases, minors of the Negro race, through their legal representatives, seek the aid of the courts in obtaining admission to the public schools of their community on a non-segregated basis. In each instance, they had been denied admission to schools attended.
There was an awesome quiet in the high-ceilinged, marble-columned courtroom. The eight associate justices listened attentively to Chief Justice Warren. In the press section, reporters leaned forward, straining to catch every word. Departing from custom, the court had not given newsmen advance copies of the opinion.
The plaintiffs contend that segregated public schools are not equal and cannot be made equal, and that hence they are deprived of the equal protection of the laws. Because of the obvious importance of the question...
Shortly after the Chief Justice began reading the court's decision, the first bulletin clacked out over the wires of the news services. Chief Justice Warren today began reading the Supreme Court's decision in the public schools segregation cases, reported a major news service. The court's ruling could not be determined immediately. At 1:12 p.m., a second bulletin was sent to editors all over the world. Chief Justice Earl Warren was attacking segregation in the public schools, but had not read far enough in the court's opinion for newsmen to say that segregation was being struck down as unconstitutional.
We conclude that in the field of public education, the doctrine of separate but equal has no place. Separate educational facilities are inherently unequal. Therefore, we hold that the plaintiffs and others similarly situated for whom the actions have been brought are, by reason of the segregation complained of, deprived of the equal protection of the laws guaranteed by the 14th Amendment. We have now announced that such segregation is a denial of the equal protection of the laws.
Chief Justice Warren finished reading at 1:20 p.m. The ruling was crystal clear. Racial segregation in the public schools violated the Constitution of the United States. The decision was unanimous. The Supreme Court had reached its conclusion in the case of Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka, and these United States would never be the same again.
The Voice of America presents In the Case of Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka, the story of the case, the Supreme Court's decision, and its far-reaching aftermath. Stuart Spencer reads the words of former Chief Justice Earl Warren, and Harry Monroe is the narrator.
Although it is the capital of the state of Kansas, as well as the seat of Shawnee County, Topeka is a small town by any standards. According to the latest U.S. Bureau of Census estimates, its population of approximately 120,000 persons ranks it as 124th among the towns and cities of the United States. Located in the northeastern part of Kansas, Topeka owes its birth to Colonel Cyrus K. Holliday, a young Pennsylvanian who came to the territory of Kansas in 1854 with $20,000 and an urge to build a railroad. And its name to an Omaha Indian word meaning good place to dig potatoes. Originally, nothing more than a cluster of wooden shacks inhabited mostly by people working for the company started by Colonel Holliday, a company which eventually became the famous Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe Railroad, Topeka boasts now an outstanding municipal college with an excellent art museum, a fine public park, a zoo, an extensive rose garden, a huge automotive tire plant, and the world-famous Menninger Clinic for the Mentally Ill. A village of 700 inhabitants during the 1850s and 60s, Topeka grew to more than 5,000 by 1870, keeping pace with the period of phenomenal growth the entire state of Kansas enjoyed after the Civil War. An enlightened community in an enlightened state, Topeka attracted a large number of exodusters, former slaves who left the war-shattered South to settle in friendlier surroundings. The oldest and most compact black community of Topeka, Tennessee Town, was established by 500 exodusters in 1880. Today, however, not all the blacks of Topeka reside in Tennessee Town. By the time our story begins, in the second half of the 1940s, many of them lived in what may be described as integrated neighborhoods, with whites and blacks living on the same streets, often working for the same companies, shopping in the same store, their children playing together. But even if they did play together, they couldn't go to the same schools. For the state of Kansas allowed each school district to establish its own guidelines in terms of educating those children, and the Board of Education of Topeka believed in the separate but equal doctrine.
The separate but equal principle in American education was prevalent for many, many years, and it provided primarily for a principle of allowing separate schools for white children and separate schools for black children to exist in many of the areas of the United States.
Duane Mathias, former Executive Deputy Commissioner of Education of the United States.
The most fundamental wrong with the separate but equal school systems that were operating in the nation, I suppose, could be said to be inherently against the civil right of an individual who was prevented from going to one school simply because of his race. In some instances, the programs and the facilities were excellent by any comparison. But the mere fact that a child was not able to go to a school of his choice or to a school nearest to his neighborhood, but for whatever reason was not able to choose his school, but was instead required to go to a school only for his race, was deemed to be inherently wrong.
There's no way that two schools, one for black and one for white, could be equal. No way.
Lucinda Todd, a retired school teacher and former secretary, Topeka Chapter, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People.
But people here, the Negro population here, had gone along with that. They were well satisfied. They liked their teachers. I would say that the children were getting A comparative education. We didn't have all the equipment the other schools had. But as far as reading and writing and arithmetic, they were doing very well. But now what it was doing to the colored child, to realize that he had to be set off here by himself. He's something that can't mix with other people, you see. This is the danger. And this is where the seriousness of the thing was.
But Linda Brown, age 9, a student at Monroe Elementary School in Topeka, Kansas, knew very little about civil rights or the psychological factors of segregation or the 14th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. What she did know, however, was that going to school was not a simple matter.
The little girl was living within 2 blocks, I believe, of a school. And yet she had crossed railroad tracks, crossed Kansas Avenue and all that traffic to get to a bus and ride 24 blocks. Now, the bus picked up quite a few children, but she was number one. And she was first early in the morning. She would often get to the school before the doors were open. And the janitor would always hear her banging around. And she took an awful lot of cold and a lot of discomfort.
Within a short period of time, however, Linda Brown would learn about civil rights and segregation and the 14th Amendment to the Constitution firsthand. The case of Linda Brown was not unique. In 17 of the United States, the law required separate but equal public schools. Segregation of the races had been upheld by a famous Supreme Court decision in 1896. The court found that such separation did not imply the inferiority of either group, and the federal government was absolutely powerless to do anything about the whole matter. Of the 15,000 local school districts, several hundred held that the separate but equal doctrine was fair to the children. The parents of some of the pupils in the black schools of Clarendon County, South Carolina, Prince Edward, Virginia, Hockessin and Claymont, Delaware, the District of Columbia, and Topeka, Kansas, did not agree. They held that the separate but equal doctrine violated their civil rights, that it did not offer them equality before the laws as provided for by the 14th Amendment. In 1950, with the aid of the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, they went to court. 5 suits were filed. All but one were lost, and all were appealed to the Supreme Court of the United States. On May 17, 1954, the Supreme Court found that
in these days, it is doubtful that any child may reasonably be expected to succeed in life if he is denied the opportunity of an education. Such an opportunity, where the state has undertaken to provide it, is a right which must be made available to all on equal terms. We come then to the question presented. Does segregation of children in public schools solely on the basis of race, even though the physical facilities and other tangible factors may be equal, deprive the children of the minority group of equal educational opportunities? We believe that it does.
But this was not the end of the struggle. It was a beginning. For racial segregation in many parts of the United States was much more than a matter of laws. It was an accepted way of life. Violence broke out in several states where attempts were made to abide by the Supreme Court's ruling. Americans watched on television incredulously as white students threw rocks and eggs at the first black student who attempted to enter the University of Alabama. Then watched warily the National Guard of Arkansas
called to active duty by the state governor, prevent 9 Negro students from entering a previously all-white high school in Little Rock. Watched with increasing nervousness, white students and adults picket and jeer at the attempts to integrate the public schools in New Orleans, Louisiana. Only in the state of Georgia was integration in public education achieved peacefully. Then violence broke out in Anniston, Birmingham, and Montgomery, Alabama. Even as the President of the United States was making a television address specifically appealing to rioting students at the University of Mississippi to remain calm following the admission of a Negro student, 2 men were killed and many injured. By then, a seemingly insignificant incident had taken place on a bus in the city of Montgomery, Alabama. A local seamstress, Mrs. Rosa Parks, who was black, had refused to give up her seat to a white person, as was the custom. She was arrested and fined $10. For the next 365 days, no Negro rode on a bus in Montgomery, a boycott with no precedent in this country. Within a few months, similar boycotts had been started in several cities, all with a single aim, to end racial segregation on public transportation. Then came the largest demonstrations aimed at ending racial discrimination in every segment of life in these United States. In 1963, thousands of Negroes began to demonstrate in Birmingham, Alabama, seeking greater civil rights. Leading them was a simple, quiet man, a dreamer.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Yeah. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that my 4 little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
His name was Martin Luther King, and he was a doctor of divinity, a minister of the gospel. He became the leader of the civil rights movement in this country. Marching behind him were thousands and thousands of black men, women, and children, arm in arm with thousands of white men, women, and children, trying to alleviate the ills that still plagued this nation. For some, it was not enough. And they took to the streets. Los Angeles, Newark, Detroit, Chicago. More than 70 cities were torn with looting and lawlessness, riot and revolt. They weren't planned. They happened. No one knew where they would happen next, how or where the next riot would erupt. But most people knew why.
Homes, decent homes, that's what the hell they want here.
Right, right.
That's what they want is homes.
Homes, decent homes, that's what they wanted. and justice. It was guaranteed them by the Constitution and by a new law Congress had just passed and President Lyndon Johnson had just signed.
The purpose of this law is simple. It does not give special treatment to any citizen. It does say the only limit to a man's hope for happiness and for the future of his children shall be his own ability. It does say that there are those who are equal before God shall now also be equal in the polling booths, in the classrooms, in the factories, and in hotels and restaurants and movie theaters and other places that provide service to the public.
Little by little, every last vestige of the sore on the face of American life that was segregation was being removed. But the dreamer from the South would never live to see the day when the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners would sit at the table of brotherhood. On April 4th, 1968, Martin Luther King was dead. The gentle proponent of nonviolence, violently dead, gunned down by a white man.
Get them! Get them!
Within a few hours, several cities exploded in the worst rioting of a decade marked by riots. An aching national sore, an agony for black and white Americans alike, a complex problem created by complicated causes and subject to no easy solution. But a problem which most black and white leaders felt could be solved much more constructively and constitutionally at the ballot box. In the fall of 1968, Americans, all Americans, black and white, went to the polls. The state of Massachusetts elected the first black senator since the days following the Civil War. Cleveland, Ohio, and Gary, Indiana, elected the first Negro mayors in their history. But it was the news of an election in a small community in the state of Mississippi, in the Deep South, that a black mayor had been elected that made national front-page headlines. By the time Newark, New Jersey, and Los Angeles, California, elected their first black mayors, it was still front-page news, almost forgotten news, when word came from Georgia that the people of Atlanta had elected the first Negro mayor in the city's history.
We owe our victory in part to a vote of confidence from a significant portion of the white community.
Maynard Jackson, the mayor of Atlanta, Georgia, on election night.
And to one hell of a turnout from the black community.
It's been 25 years since the Supreme Court of the United States ruled that racial segregation in public education was unconstitutional. 25 eventful years for this country. 25 years of progress in civil rights. And the principles in the case of Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka? Many are gone. Others are still around and fighting for the rights of the individual. The Reverend Oliver Brown, who wanted his daughter Linda to attend a school nearer her home and started the whole chain of events, is dead. And Linda, his daughter, the 9-year-old girl who became the focus of attention, is divorced now after a brief marriage, her own son and daughter going to schools in Topeka, a town changed by the decision announced 25 years ago by Chief Justice Earl Warren. Or was it?
I can't say that they are completely integrated.
Charles Scott, an attorney at law from Topeka, currently a hearing examiner for the Kansas Commission on Civil Rights. 25 years ago, Mr. Scott was one of the attorneys for the plaintiffs in the case of Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka.
Of course, you'd have to recognize the housing patterns in which we yet have a tremendous imbalance of races in the various public schools here in the city of Topeka. And so we're yet not in compliance with the mandate and the expectations of the Brown decision.
Moreover, immediately preceding the commencement of the 1978 school year, here in Topeka, the school board adopted a open enrollment program which permits the child or the parents of the child to exercise an option to attend any of the schools within the school district. Representatives of the black community are watching this program with some degree of suspicion, with the understanding, of course, that we're very much apprehensive that this might be a program that would certainly invite noncompliance with the mandate of the Brown decision by permitting racial imbalance, which we certainly are hopeful of avoiding.
And in the rest of the country, is there full and complete equality of the races in the United States today? The answer is no. But we're working at it.
I believe that this is one of the finest things that has ever happened to our country. And it's brought a much greater degree of freedom and of liberty and of self-expression to the white citizens, perhaps, and even to the black, because in the past we were completely preoccupied, many of them, and now we've found that we can live harmoniously together, and we've moved forward a great deal since that time in a very beneficial way.
Have been listening to In the Case of Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka. Stuart Spencer read the words of former Supreme Court Justice Earl Warren, and Harry Monroe was the narrator. The program was written by Michael A. Hanu.